Welcome back once again to the Lumieres podcast. Yes, somehow I'm still here and this is really happening. You're not dreaming, or maybe you are. Either way, today I have a very special episode to share with you because today is the day that my first book, Chimera, is released. Hey, yes, thank you. So to give it its full title, Chimera, Living Through Leukemia, a Memoir, is the alchemical story of my teenage near-death experience. I'll read you the blurb so you can get an idea of what's going on between these pages. Jodie White's 18th year of life filled his heart with young love, only to break him apart. Diagnosed with a rare form of acute leukemia, he was given just 2 weeks to live. After a whirlwind of intensive treatment and close to death, he dreamed his way into the care of a wizened cowboy, his own personal SWAT team, and a mysterious old crone who wanders the desert collecting wolf bones. Chimera is an alchemical dive into teenage illness, a near-death initiation framed by the innate mythic stories that touch all our lives. I'm really proud and excited about this book, and I still can't quite believe it's actually out there starting its journey into the world. How amazing. I decided to launch it with a crowdfunder last summer. Over 100 backers raised around £5,000 to support the production of the first copies of the book, and 20% of that went to charity. This was a very special moment for me, so I'm really thankful to all those of you who supported the project. If any of you are listening, once again, thank you so very much. It was really a magical experience for me, if a hell of a lot of work. Because not only was there the pandemic to contend with, the latter half of 2021 also brought with it perhaps the most stressful 6 months in my personal life I think I've ever been through. Without going into too much detail, with all the challenges and emotional turmoil going on, there were days I wasn't quite sure how I was going to move forward. Yet, bizarrely, there was still an underlying sense that it was all part of the flow of my life, something to be ridden out rather than raged against. And I'm 100% sure that dedicating myself to finishing this book got me through. I've been getting some lovely reviews coming in from some of those early backers, as well as from a recent blog tour of Bookstagrammers, and I thought I'd read you a few to see, so you can hear what people have been saying so far. These are from people who backed the crowdfunder, who then read the book and were nice enough to leave a short review on the Goodreads website. This one's from Jo Arnott. Thank you, Jo. She writes, "Cancer, leukemia, chemotherapy. Words we're all familiar with, but not necessarily what you might want to read about. Except Jodie has written about his own teenage experience of them in such a way that I literally couldn't put this book down. Beautifully written, this powerful and moving memoir is full of hope and positivity." Oh, bless her. Thank you, Jo. And Owen Shears, a lovely Owen Shears, wrote, "Jodie's moving and humbling account of his journey with leukemia is thoroughly engrossing and wonderfully written. You're there with him every step of the way. I really enjoyed how he manages to marry the visceral and brutal nature of the condition and treatment with his own internal journey. I feel like the teachings he gleaned from the experience have been passed on to me as a result of reading this book. An appreciation for being alive, however fleeting, and a gratitude for the blessings of good health." And I hope you agree if you do end up reading it. Obviously, you're welcome not to agree. Sarah Argyle said, "Jodie takes us through his illness and his treatment with such clarity and covering so many aspects of his emotional and sometimes medication-fueled inner world that it literally feels like living and dying each moment with him." And then, there's loads more. If you want to go over to the Goodreads page, you can have a look at what people have been saying about the book, which is really, really heartwarming to hear. And although I'm trying not to be overly attached to reviews, you can't help but be affected when this project that you've been working on for so long is out there and then people start receiving it so warmly. So I'm really grateful to the people that have been enjoying it and getting something from it. And recently it's been on a little thing called a blog tour, which is where people on Instagram who read lots of books and blog about books all the time read your book and then they tell their audiences what they think. And that was quite an interesting experience. Here's a few of the headlines from those. So Heidi and her books, she said, eye-opening, raw and important. I think this is one everyone needs to read in their lifetime. Wow. That was pretty intense and amazing to receive in her review of the book. Thank you, Heidi. A beautifully written and heartfelt memoir, said wee Glasgow bookworm. And Chapman's Chapters and Pages, Lizzie Chapman, she said, thank you for helping us to understand the fragile thread of life is to be cherished and never taken for granted. So, sounds like a pretty good read, am I right? Well, if you want to read it, you can buy the book online now at your favourite platform, be that Amazon, Kobo, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, and many others. If you do decide to purchase it, I really hope you enjoy reading the book. As I've said, it's been a labour of love to kind of get it out and get it to you and put it out into the world. But judging from what people have been saying about it so far, it's been well worth it. And if you do buy the book and if you do read the book, please consider writing a short review on whichever platform you bought it from when you're finished. If you're also able to put that review onto the Goodreads page for the book, you get super extra special brownie points. Just search for Jodie White Mara on there and it should come up. To find out more and sign up for a free preview PDF of the first two chapters, you can go to my website, which is jodiewhite.co.uk, jodiewhite.co.uk/the-book, the-book. There are also a few remaining signed crowdfunder copies available to purchase direct from me on there too, so if that's something that you really feel you want to do, you can do that. But this is a podcast, Jodie, I hear you ask. Yes, it is, and I have also been recording an audiobook version of Chimera. For all of you who prefer to listen to your literature these days, it seems to be an ever-growing number of folks actually, myself included. Whilst that is a couple of months away from being finished, as a very special book launch day treat, I thought I'd present the first two chapters of the audiobook exclusively here now for you lovely listeners. And if you're still with me after all this time off, then you are hardcore, and I salute you to the absolute maximum. To connect with me outside of this podcast space, I would encourage you to go to Instagram. My tag is at lifeinfractals. There's a Facebook author page now too, which is Jodie White Author. And my personal website, as I mentioned, is jodiewhite.co.uk. I think that is everything. So, without further ado, I present to you chapters 1 and 2 of Chimera, Living Through Leukemia, a memoir by me, Jodie White, read by the author. Enjoy. Chapter 1, The First Cut. Sometimes, life has a way of breaking us apart and dissolving the roots of who we thought we were before slowly piecing us back together anew. In 1999, I was a shy and sensitive 17-year-old with only a single and rather brief relationship to my name. After years of pubescent angst, I was excited to finally experience this new form of connection. Tamsin was sexy and aloof, and I constantly felt like I was dreaming while I was with her, walking on air because she had chosen me. We'd wander around Bridgnorth's high town together, looking in shop windows and kissing under the spring blossoms in Castle Park. Like so many before us, we'd hold hands in the back row of the local indie cinema, pausing at her doorstep on the way home. To help express my torrent of feelings, I'd played her a track from a Q magazine compilation, Saint by Texas, in which Charlene Spiteri pledges her entire life to her beloved. She dumped me after a few short weeks. When pressed for a reason, her response was that I was simply too nice. Clearly this fledgling take on romance had not worked in my favour. I was hurt and frustrated. Did that mean she wanted me to care less? Relationships aside, I'd done well to navigate the social strata on my journey through Bridgnorth Endowed School. I got along well with the football lads, the computer geeks, the shy girls, the it girls, the awkward kids shuttled in from small surrounding villages, the laid-back music lovers and the more open-minded teachers. I adored anyone who could adopt the role of class comedian. The popular girls laughed at my sardonic humour and we'd hang out, but I was careful never to get too close. Instead, I admired them from afar, dreaming up elaborate, hormonally charged fantasies in which they starred. I hadn't the first clue about the art of seduction, or how to handle the complexities of the opposite sex. Firmly in my favour were my well-honed skills behind a drum kit, which had proved to be a real asset when it came to attracting attention. Our band went by the terrible name of Identical Footwear, so called because we all wore kickers, the brand of choice for teenage males in the late 1990s. Rob, Rishi, Pete and I would spend our lunch hours jamming away in the school's music room. This display of youthful creativity began to attract a small crowd of our peers to the tall glass windows which lined three sides of the space. They'd crane their necks to get a better view as we cranked out surprisingly decent versions of Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll and Smashing Pumpkins' Zero. Not bad for a bunch of fresh-faced lads who could barely grow a bumfluff moustache, despite an uncanny ability to get served lukewarm pints of lager in the Carpenter's Arms on any given Friday night. Tasha hung around in the crowd who came to watch our band practices. We'd locked eyes briefly a couple of times. I'd always been quietly fascinated by her, but could count the times we'd actually spoken to each other on the fingers of one hand. She was friends with the in crowd, but she wasn't really one of them. While they revelled in their premium status amongst the social hierarchy, she presented a smiling old soul that oozed kindness and a wild, barely hidden sexuality that signalled heaven to me. I thought she was perfect. Her tumbling, dirty blonde bob had a life of its own, while experience shone from her sharp blue eyes. A streetwise tone coloured her edges as if she carried with her the weight of a secret burden. I wondered what it was. She sat on the back row of GCSE geography, chatty and bright, charming the male teachers with her sweet maturity, equally as bolshy as the lads. Some people have a certain air about them, an invisible energy that draws others in. She was like that. Sexy but not conventionally so. Feminine yet tomboyish, with her paint-splattered jeans and rusty red camper shoes. She was completely genuine and wore her heart firmly on her sleeve, a combination so unusual in this environment and consequently extremely alluring. I willed courage into my body almost daily to gain the strength to talk to her and to look into those glassy blue eyes for just a few long seconds. I wanted to soak myself in that delicious tingle that snaked itself around my chest whenever she was around. It was no good just staring at her and then trying to hide it if she so much as raised her head in my direction. If it was a particularly good day, I might even try projecting my feelings to her telepathically in an attempt to make her understand. Finally, I realised I needed a little help. My friend Jamie took A-level art. Tasha was in the same class and I knew they hung out together, smoked straights outside the school gates at 4 o'clock, and were both generally on board with the classic tenets of Team Rebellion. Jamie was something of a wild card with a difficult home life. He could be unpredictably mean, yet it was clear age was making him kinder to those he actually liked. I approached him on the way out of last period at the corner of the school where sweaty locker rooms met bleached toilets, where the solemnity of the maths department lay just beyond the threshold double doors. "Hey, dude."
"Oh, hey, Jode, how's it going?"
"Yeah, good, good. Just wondering if you could do me a favour," I began. He shot me a quizzical grin.
"Yeah, of course, mate."
"Cool, it's just, Tasha, you know her, right?"
"Yeah, Tasha's cool. Do you like her then or something?"
"Well, yeah, I do, and I just thought maybe you could mention me to her." It was a relief to actually say it. It felt as if I was opening some kind of door to the future. "Ask her if she likes me, if she wants to go out with me. I'd really appreciate it."
"Ah, interesting.
Yeah, she's a really sound girl. Actually, I think she split up with someone not so long ago, but I'll see what I can do. We've got art tomorrow morning, so she should be there." "Thanks, mate. I really appreciate it. Catch you later."
"Yeah, sure, lover boy. Laters," he smirked.
The Clicks vending machine clicked and whirred, making me a watery coffee. It was almost 9:30 a.m. and most people had drifted off to class. Jamie arrived to report his dramatic findings. Tasha was into me too. I knew this was my chance to act, step up and be the man who took a risk in the name of love, or whatever you might call this bizarre feeling. My heart began to pump faster, flushing my cheeks. I was scared shitless at the thought of seeing her armed with this new information. Minutes later, as I was about to leave the building, already late for English and knelt down trying to stuff my jacket into a bursting backpack, I saw her.
Tasha was walking up the stairs at the far end of the corridor. She was dressed in a short-sleeved checkered shirt that hugged her curves, her baggy blue bootcut sashayed this way and that, while round-toed scarlet shoes poked out playfully from beneath them. She would have to pass me. We would have to speak. Oh, fuck. I panicked, almost balked, almost said nothing. I fumbled nervously with the zip on my bag. Just as she was about to draw level, her eyes flashed to mine. Hey, I blurted. Hi. Can I talk to you? Sure. She smiled, a flush of pink in her cheeks, a faint smell of cigarette smoke. Can I talk to you? I cursed my linguistic shyness. What the fuck sort of a line is that? What an idiot. For a minute or two, we skirted around the obvious, talked about friends and school, and then... So, did James mention anything the other day? I asked. A long pause. Yeah, he did. I'm flattered. I don't know what to say. She doesn't like me. She thinks I'm an idiot. Say something. I've kind of just split up with someone, and I'm not ready to start anything else just yet. Shit. Fuck. Darkest of black days, torrential apocalyptic thunderstorms, a whirlpool of epic proportions sucking me down, down, down. But we should hang out sometime. How about Friday night? You going to be out? Sweet Jesus, I'm saved. Yeah, I should be around. Everyone going to the castle as usual? I should think so. Me, Anna and Laura will be there. You should come along. It'll be fun. That sideways smile, those dazzling eyes. Okay, cool, I will. Could she hear the sound of my heart thumping in my throat? Months of yearning, praying and attempted telepathy had somehow paid off. The girl I wanted was within my reach. It was July and the nights were long and warm. Fridays were the highlight of the social calendar in Bridgeton. The route between pubs would develop organically over the course of an evening, with arrangements and rendezvous points quickly spread through a new technology called the text message. The old castle was ramshackle in the classic English style, replete with an ageing jukebox, fruit machines aplenty, and a knackered pool table and a room of its own out back, its luminous green felt dotted with small rips and the odd fag burn. The too old to still be drinking propped up the bar while the too young to drink gathered for the first few rounds before the next establishment was decided, and the herd gradually moved on. Pints, shots, alco pops, tipple after tipple. I wasn't much of a drinker. I'd have a few too many if it was the right sort of night. The ones where you can feel friendships being forged and where boundaries melt away. But I knew my limits and didn't enjoy obliterating my brain cells anywhere near as much as everyone else. This particular night, however, called for a special effort. I took a long shower, fastidiously cleaning and lathering every limb and crevice, then swilling off the bubbles with the steaming hot water. I spent time blow-drying my hair and applying dabs of hair putty. I even stole a few puffs of Mum's hairspray. Then I had to decide what to wear. What would impress her? I was of medium slim build, though I'd recently introduced a few eager sit-ups and push-ups to my morning routine. Following the progress of my muscles in the mirror satisfied my unfolding teenage ego. I swiped a small bottle of Belgian lager from the fridge and sat in my room listening to Rage Against the Machine, the furious music imparting a sense of purpose, priming my confidence for the evening ahead. I checked my Nokia. No new texts. As was traditional, I met my good friend Rob at the junction of Queensway Drive and Dunval Close, and together we sauntered towards the bustling town centre, where over a dozen pubs lay within a few minutes' walk of each other. After getting our pints at the castle's main bar, we moved past the old-timers to the terraced garden where all the kids hung out. Immediately, I saw her. Tasha was sat at a picnic bench drinking a white Russian, shining like a beacon in a tight white shirt. That night was dreamlike, rare in its lucidity. As the laughter rang out and the drinks flowed, we exchanged lingering looks, flirting with the tension, territory marked out by the closeness of our bodies. Hours flew by. Things became fluid, softly blurred at the edges. My confidence soared. The group mind shifted and the next location was decided. The Carpenter's Arms was a small and lively pub on the other side of town, a particular favourite amongst those who straddled the boundary of the UK's legal drinking age. Tasha and I pitched up at the bar, leaning over the toweled mats and stainless steel drip trays to make an order. Jack Daniels and Coke was the drink for this point in the evening, the sweet black elixir with a kick in the tail. Laura ordered Bacardi Breezes, nudging me in the ribs with a less than subtle wink, and we all sat down around a small wooden table. Just me and three lovely young ladies. I felt like a king. Tash caught my eye. You okay? I am definitely okay, I replied with a grin. Well, that's good. She kissed my cheek, leapt up and shimmied her way over to the jukebox, putting on some Stone Roses and danced her way off to the toilets. As she sat back down, I took a deep breath. It was time for a little boldness. Under the table, my right hand slipped smoothly onto Tasha's left thigh. She smiled but continued her conversation across the table with Laura. Then, taking a sip of her drink, she responded with a reciprocal manoeuvre, her eyes flicking to meet mine. After this daring first move, things went better than I could have hoped. Leaving the pub, we walked the length of the high street, hand in hand, tipsy and giggling, not caring who saw us. An indie disco was held every other Friday above the Comrades Club in a large wooden-floored room. You could drink until 1 a.m, so we all flocked there after last orders at the pubs. Inhibitions truly dissolved, we hit the dance floor, holding each other close, snaking in time to the beat and the pulse. Beneath the smoke, flashing deep reds and greens lit up our bodies. The rest of the room fell away, only her eyes remained in sharp focus. Suddenly I kissed her, and all at once she became mine. Our mouths pressed together, all soft lips and trembling tongues. Perfume, cigarettes, sweat. The testosterone flowed. I lost all track of time. At 2 a.m, the staff began kicking us all out. I've got to go now, Jode, but I've had such a great night. Me too, Tash. When can I see you again? I was breathless, hungry for more. I'm going away for a few weeks over the summer. All the girls are going to Tenerife, and then I'm going to Africa with my family. But I'll send you a postcard. Let's swap addresses, she instructed, handing me a piece of tattered blue paper and a pen from her bag. Details duly imparted, we withdrew to the main doorway, where we hugged and softly kissed again. Then she was gone, her smell on my t-shirt and the watery, indescribable taste of her on my tongue. I was dazed and drunk. It was long gone too, and sleep beckoned. I decided to walk home, still not quite able to take it all in. What strange magic was this? This smart, sassy girl was truly into me. I felt invincible, which worked wonders for my wavering self-esteem. For a brief while, life felt perfect. Summer bloomed into lazy days with nowhere to be and nothing to do, a time that seems to exist only in the haze of teenage memories. We barely saw each other, though every couple of weeks a cute illustrated postcard would arrive with details of where she'd been and what she'd been up to. The first one had a garish Tenerife sunset slapped on the front, and a message scrawled in thick red pen over most of the reverse, with absolutely no concern for the neat four lines of allotted space. I pictured her bumming a pen from some helpless shopkeeper. Hey you, having a great time in Tenerife, all the girls say hi. See you soon, miss you. T. Two kisses. I spent much of my time daydreaming about her. I'd ride my bike through the suburbs of the town, across the river and along to Severn Park, following the path along the riverside to the wildflower meadows at the far end, the part where they didn't cut the grass as often and where no one really went. My backpack contained a bottle of water, my smoking tin and a selection of books. Half stuck to the inside pocket was the remains of a sticky bag of boiled sweets. I'd sit by the river, plugged into my music player, a battered notepad close at hand. I wrote poems, diary entries, all my wishes and fears, thoughts and impressions. It was as if some dormant cognitive function in my brain was now fully active. I felt renewed and inspired, completely buzzing with vital life force energy. In Ibiza, my family had rented a small villa on the outskirts of Santa Eulalia. We baked our bodies on and off for almost 2 weeks in the Balearic heat. I spent the days lying on the terracotta-tiled roof, gazing up at the endless blue sky, then wandering down to the beach in the afternoons to cool off in the glassy Mediterranean. I devoured a couple of Russell Hoban books. My parents laughed a lot and got mildly sunburnt. My two younger sisters, Gemma and Jessie, dunked each other in the pool, while my little brother Josh watched, grinning from ear to ear before boldly taking a running jump into the water himself. We ate freshly baked baguettes smothered in thick garlic aioli, ordered steaming paella, and sipped bottles of chilled San Miguel. In the darkness of my bedroom, wrapped in a sun-kissed glow, I envisioned Tasha lying next to me. As I fell asleep, I tried to calculate the distance that lay between us. Where was she? Who was she with? Was she thinking of me too? As we took our last trips around the island, I became aware that such thoughts were being slowly replaced by a creeping sense of paranoia. We'd be in the car driving back from lunch on the beach or a walk around a small fishing village, and a sudden feeling of dread would descend upon me. My bountiful happiness wavered. The rash that had been appearing on and off since we arrived had finally decided to hang around and make itself noticed. All across my stomach and spreading around to my back was a raised area of pinky red skin that itched like hell. It had spread along the inside of my left thigh too, and any amount of cream wouldn't persuade it to leave. My muttering and complaining were starting to affect the general mood. "Calm down, you've probably just overdone the sun a little," Dad said, matter-of-factly. From the kitchen, Mum shouted something about making sure I was using factor 30. "Give it until we get home. I'm sure it'll have gone by then, love. And listen to your mother." His confident smile eased my worries. He turned back to his book, a chunky Len Dighton, took a sip of his beer and adjusted the position of his faded baseball cap. I believed him. Parents have a knack for knowing just what to say to soothe their offspring's frazzled edges. Monday, the 6th of September. The first day of the rest of my life. Our first days as A-level students. We'd graduated from secondary school and were now entering the twilight of our teenage years. We were losing our innocence, slowly maturing. I had barely stopped thinking about Tasha all summer and had worked myself up into a nervous wreck before breakfast. This was it. We would finally get to cement our relationship and make it real. I knew she felt the same. She had to. She knew they were no ordinary kisses. It was not just another Friday night out on the town. We had started something there, under the flickering strobe lights. At 8:55 a.m, Mr. Phelps, the head of sixth form, ambled into the common room from his adjoining office.
"All right, you Philistines, shut up, shut up," boomed his deep Welsh accent.
A few titters bounced around the room, but no one wanted to make a fuss on the first day back, so we gamely took our seats for the register. She still wasn't here. My heart was pounding. I tried to ignore it.
"Matthews!"
"Here, sir."
"Miss Jones?"
"Sir."
"Mr. Davies," he repeated.
A few sniggers leaked out.
"Mr. Davies?"
he called once more. He paused to survey the room over the top of his thick black spectacles, then rolled his eyes.
"If someone would be so kind as to suppress their giggles and inform me of the whereabouts of Mr. Davies, then I would be eternally grateful." "He's taking a dump, sir," someone said.
More sniggers.
"Fantastic. Where was I?"
He was about to continue when the double doors swung open and Tasha burst through, her skin tanned and smooth, her cheeks flushed. Turning, she picked me out of the crowd and flashed a quick smile. I thought I might crack.
"Sorry, sir, we had a problem with the car on the way in."
She grinned and took a seat next to Anna.
"Thank you, Miss Claude. Now, where were we?"
I became flushed and self-conscious and looked away, fiddled with my laces, slid my hand inside the front section of my backpack. I wrapped my fingers around the paper bag which contained the few small gifts I'd selected at the hippie market in Escanar, and gripped it like a trophy. After registration, people wandered out to the first lessons of the day. A few groups lingered, catching up on the gossip. Tasha was sat with two of her friends by a window that looked out over the faded concrete of the Year 11 yard. I approached them, trying to look confident, trying to feel at ease. Anna noticed me first, then Laura, with a knowing smile. Tash turned to me, her blue eyes sparkled. I thought I might turn to stone, but somehow I managed to force out some words. Anna and Laura got up and left, and suddenly there we were, just the two of us.
"Hey, you okay?"
I started.
"It's been a weird morning, Jode, but yes, all the better for seeing you."
She gave me a big hug. My heart danced.
"How was your summer? I missed you." I missed you too. Did you get my postcards?
Yeah, I love them. It was a funny summer, I'll tell you all about it later.
I brought you these, I began, sifting through the contents of my backpack to find the market gifts. I watched as she unwrapped the contents, praying I hadn't gone too far.
Oh wow, I love them, she blushed, smiling.
Thank you. She planted a soft kiss on my burning cheek and looked right into me with those piercing blue eyes. At that moment, I decided I would do everything in my power to keep that look on her face. As we walked, I slipped my hand into hers. Her warm fingers gave a light squeeze in reply. Reaching the door where our paths divided, I moved to kiss her, but before I could, she hugged me and said, "Let's meet at free period." She pecked me on the cheek and bounded away. I watched her go. As she reached the corner and was about to vanish, she turned back, flashed me a grin, and was gone. Without really trying, we fell into a natural groove and spent much of the next few weeks together, kissing, talking into the early hours, getting tipsy on weak beer and high on cheap hash. I lost my virginity to Tasha in the living room of my parents' house on their red and green floral sofa one late September afternoon when we really should have been at school. She had a little more experience than me, which helped my confidence. We got so carried away in the moment that at some point in the proceedings I realised we hadn't even bothered to close the curtains. With my face pressed to her bare breast, a wave of embarrassment hit me. "Tash, the curtains." Barely opening her eyes, she pulled me closer and whispered into my ear, "Leave them." By October, autumn had truly arrived with its dramatic colourways and particular quality of light. The slowly bruising sky told me it was a late afternoon and the school day was winding up. A bunch of us hung around in our usual common room spot, the corner seats by the floor-to-ceiling window which commanded a general's eye view over the playground. Laughing and joking and general piss-taking ensued, everyone participating in the comedy of the moment. The CD player pumped out the new Incubus album which held us in raptures. Tasha walked in. The double door swung back and the rest of the world slowed to a crawl. I drank in the high dimples in her cheeks that shone when she laughed. She winked at me. Jamie, sitting off to the right of the group, caught my eye. I felt the sweat start to form patches under my arms and tried to steady myself, leaning back from the chatter bubble. Tasha and her friend Hilda, a German exchange student, headed straight for the corner, taking their seats along the row of blue chairs with a volley of upbeat hellos and how's it goings, a quick kiss for me. A few strongly machined coffees and some cheap chocolate bars later, and there were only four of us. Everyone else had classes to go to, cigarettes to smoke or pubs to frequent. Jamie and I sat opposite the girls. Tasha squeezed my feet while he practiced his flirtation techniques on the helpless Hilda. Eventually, Tash and her friend left to catch their lift and Jamie went off to his car. After they'd all gone, I noticed a small piece of crumpled white paper on the seat where Tash had been sitting. I picked it up and unfolded it. It was a page ripped from her school workbook, over which were scrawled various games of squares and several love sums. Across one corner in blue biro were the words, "Tasha Claude loves Jodie White." Chapter 2. Diagnosis Day. Since returning to school, Tasha and I saw each other regularly. She lived with her family in a converted mill tucked away at the bottom of a pretty dingle out in the Shropshire countryside. The house was picture perfect, split over three levels with a brook running past the ample gardens. She'd laugh at my terrible jokes and we'd drink Red Stripe while Orbital's insides pumped out from the CD player. Lying on her bed, the girl with the sun in her head would trace her fingers along my forearm, triggering waves of sparks underneath my skin. Time ceased to be linear. We were merging into each other's worlds and life had taken on a whole new sparkle despite the shortening days. Thoughts of the past faded from my mind. I barely even dreamt of the future. She drew me into the now, that mysterious place where she lived. She helped me learn how to feel alive there, open to the birth of opportunity. That sense of excitement was intoxicating and her company quickly became a place I wanted to return to again and again. Tempering this efflorescent love were various ailments that had been irritating me for some time. The mysterious rashes of the summer had abated. In their place were a variety of other anomalies,
earaches, unexplained bouts of feeling run down, and a tickly dry throat that stubbornly refused to go away. Most recently, I'd woken up one day in early October with the volume knob of my world turned down a few notches. Sounds were muffled and I struggled to hear what people were saying. Clearly, I needed to get checked out. Bridgnorth Medical Practice was situated in a tall townhouse on the high street, fronted by an imposing red door. The waiting room was tucked away at the rear of the building inside an ornate Victorian conservatory, filled with lush tropical plants and a trickling water feature. Unfortunately, these pretty facades were unable to mask the timeless weight of sickness. The unnatural stench of sanitizer hung like winter mist over the room as its motley crew of occupants waited to be prescribed their various pills and potions. Each time I went to the surgery, the doctor would repeat the same procedure. A huge plastic thermometer would be inserted into my ear, then my blood pressure was taken with one of those ugly pump-up cuffs. Finally, he'd gaze down my throat, spying on my tonsils with his jet-black pen torch. I would leave with a prescription for penicillin, or a steroid cream, or some antibiotic eardrops. Each time, these things did nothing to fix my issues. The hearing loss was the real icing on the cake, though. At this point, I was acutely aware that something wasn't working properly in my skinny teenage body, and I was beginning to get depressed. Tasha and my family were understanding, but they couldn't do much more than offer their hopeful reassurance that things would no doubt improve. My latest visit had proved no different. "If these don't work, then we'll have to do a blood test," Dr. Goodall said. "There's always a chance it could be glandular fever. It's quite common at your age." I wasn't sure if this was supposed to make me feel better, and I left the surgery with gloom hanging off my face. I was walking up the high street towards the iconic North Gate, heading for home, when I saw Tasha coming towards me, pulling a young girl along behind her. "Hey!" She seemed half pleased, half embarrassed to see me. "Hey, Tash," I said, and planted a quick kiss on her lips. "Say hello, Ches." "Hi, Francesca." I tried a smile and a wave. She frowned back at me, defiantly silent. "What did they say?" asked Tash. "He thinks it's some sort of virus. Couldn't be sure, though. They gave me these," I replied. I shook my green and white striped pharmacy bag with faux triumph. "It's so fucking annoying. It's been 2 weeks now and I still don't feel any better. I wish it would just all go away." "It'll be all right," she said, laying her hand gently on top of my shoulder. Francesca giggled. We ignored her. "Wait and see if the new drugs do something. And if they don't, you can give them to me," she laughed. "Yeah, right," I rolled my eyes. "Look, I've got to get back for dinner. I'll see you tomorrow. Are we still on for American Beauty on Friday? As long as we don't need to get you a hearing aid, mister," she poked my chest playfully. I wrinkled my nose, flashing pretend daggers, and leant over to kiss her cheek. It blushed pink at the touch. The fine light hairs on her face smelled like coconut. "See you later, hot stuff," she said. I turned and watched them wander off down the street, hand in hand like two drunken pirates, laughing and bumping into each other, swaying to the invisible rhythms of the sea. A week later, at around 10:30, I was sat in the third row of Ms. Mannion's A-level English class, a sense of shame steadily glowing across my cheeks. My hearing was operating at about half its usual volume, and consequently I was having real trouble understanding what was being taught, enduring a rigorous piss-taking from my classmates as a result. As the lesson progressed, I grew more and more frustrated. After class, I walked the short distance down the hill from the school grounds into town for yet another appointment. Enough was enough. Something needed to be done. I saw a stand-in by the name of Dr. Allen, an amiable guy who I'd seen once before and immediately warmed to. He was happy to listen to what I had to say and appeared genuinely concerned with getting to the bottom of it all, quite refreshing given my previous experiences in the building. "Okay, Jodie, I'm sorry that we haven't been able to find out what's causing your issues. I'm going to give you a prescription for some general antibiotics and book you in for a blood test at the hospital. They have a clinic open until 2 p.m. this afternoon, so if you go down there now, we should have the results back in a couple of days," he informed. Then there was a pause. "All right?" He smiled awkwardly and handed me the freshly printed form. I left the surgery with the folded paper clasped tightly in hand and wandered the short distance under the North Gate and down to the town's small general hospital. It was prime time for the lunch trade, and the town centre was gently humming with local shoppers picking up their groceries and small gangs of kids sneaking out of school to buy a cone of chips. I'd only been in the main hospital building once before, several years prior, for a hernia operation. Memory served me up images of a dark, musty environment populated by people with drips and deep wrinkles, faces etched with sadness. It could have been the general anaesthetic, but there was something strange about the way the shadows bounced around the bleached walls in that old brick building that made me feel like I'd walked onto the set of a low-budget art house horror film. The blood clinic was situated around the back of the main complex in a newly built annex. Its large glass windows let in plenty of natural light and subsequently felt much more comfortable. I announced myself to the middle-aged nurse on reception, who crossed me off her list with practiced aplomb. Elderly warfarin patients read well-thumbed copies of People's Friend magazine, and young children bawled after their booster injections. Everyone else looked ever so slightly nervous to be spending time in a place so steeped in the starkness of our own mortality. They called me through after only a few minutes. The nurse had already done 13 patients so far that morning and was in no mood for pleasantries. She sat next to me sternly, content with the stony silence. The tourniquet was tight and uncomfortable. My bulging veins wriggled like worms trapped under my skin. I turned to look out of the window. I'd never had a blood test before. How simple it was, all over in a flash. "Okay, now take a deep breath in, please. Sharp scratch." A rapid burning sensation flooded up my arm as she pierced the skin. "Wow, that stung." "You've got very good veins," she said, casually filling several vials of blood from a tube in the crook of my left arm. Thanks. The blood was surprisingly dark, like a fine Malbec. She labelled each tube and placed them into a tray. "All done, you're free to go." She got up and poked her head out the door. "Next, please." "Sorry, do you know when I'll be able to find out the results?" "We'll get them back to you tomorrow. Just give your GP surgery a ring. Next, please." Around 5 p.m. that same day, the phone in our hallway began to ring. Since the blood test, I'd been at home all afternoon, distracting myself from my rushing thoughts in any way I could, primarily by teasing my youngest sister Jessie, and generally messing around. As I heard the shrill ringing echo through the house, part of me immediately knew the nature of the call, knew that my life was about to change. This knowing manifested as a torrent of anxiety that flew across my chest, spiralled up my spine, and finally paused to linger at the back of my heart. I couldn't bring myself to leave my bedroom and pick up the phone. I let it ring on. While Dad was still at work in Wolverhampton and wouldn't be back till 6, Mum had been working from her makeshift office on the wooden table in our dining room that afternoon. Jessie was on the sofa watching kids' TV. I heard the handle creak as she opened the kitchen door and moved towards the bottom of the stairs. The ringing stopped. I sprang from my horizontal position on the bed and moved quietly to the top of the stairs, watching her from my elevated viewpoint, trying to gauge her reaction. She was listening and nodding, saying, "Of course, right, okay," and then, "We'll be down right away. Okay, thanks." Her face told a story I didn't want to hear, corroborating my fears. She realised I had been watching her and glanced up to the landing. I walked slowly down the carpeted stairs towards her. I could see her hazel eyes were beginning to water a little at the edges. "That was the doctors, Jode. They've got your blood results back and they want to see us down at the surgery. They say it's quite important that we go as soon as we can." She was trying to hide her worry, trying so very hard. "Did they say why?" "No, just that we need to go down there now." "Oh God, Mum. It's going to be something horrible, isn't it?" I said. Unease had turned to rising panic. "Now we don't know that. Let's just pop down and see what they have to say," she replied. She turned away quickly to gather her jacket and car keys. We left 11-year-old Jessie on the sofa, her face quietly concerned, and climbed into Mum's tiny Nissan Micra. Neither of us said much on the short drive into town until Mum broke the silence. "It's probably just nothing, maybe a virus. Don't worry, it'll be okay." I don't think she really believed that, but I appreciated the sentiment. Another wave of foreboding hit me. Clearly, this was serious.
I'm sure we both knew it, but neither of us wanted to feed the fear demons any more bloody morsels. Spotting a rare parking space on the high street, we pulled up directly outside the surgery's front door. No hanging around in stuffy waiting rooms for us today, oh no. We were ushered straight in and straight up to the first floor where the doctor's rooms were located. After a couple of polite knocks, we were called into the plush wood-panelled office of one of the main partners. A rather slick and aloof man, I'd always felt repelled by his sour demeanour. What twisted irony then that he should be the one to deliver the news? I eyed him suspiciously as we began to speak a few words of greeting. He looked decidedly uncomfortable, which was less than reassuring. Jody, we received a call from the hospital an hour ago regarding your blood test. Your white blood cell count is 323, that's extremely high. I'm afraid... He paused, perhaps trying to find the words. You have leukemia. What can you say to that? What is the official reaction to a cancer diagnosis? Tears? Anger? Anguish? All of that. Yet at first, for me, there was simply nothing. A void. For a second or two, my mind stuttered to a halt as if struck by a processing error, a neuronal collision. The past and future combined and contracted at light speed, slamming me into the distorted, twisted present. Life as I knew it collapsed, crumbled into dust and fell through my fingers. School, my family, my girlfriend, my friends. Would I even live to see another week? I felt a throbbing headache coming on. Surely life couldn't be ending now, just as it was starting to truly begin. Something cracked inside me. At my side, Mum uttered a guttural cry, crumpling into herself. I reached out for her hand and we gripped each other too tightly. We sat sobbing together, high on uncertainty, faced with the very real threat of an untimely and painful separation. I pressed my face into her woven woolen jacket, my tears and saliva pooling into a cocktail of dark stains. "We'll fight this. We can fight this," came her high-pitched whisper into my mess of hair. I had no words with which to reply. She tried to pull herself together, using all of her strength to retain some degree of composure. I understood she was desperately trying to be strong for my sake. She asked the doctor a question as I zoned out, dazed and reeling, trying to catch my stuttering breath. Their voices became a blur of sound in the background. I felt the floor open up beneath me, its depth felt endless. After what felt like forever, I wiped my eyes with Mum's tissues, blew my snotty nose and looked up at the doctor. He shifted uncomfortably in his seat, his pale face painted with sorrow. He sighed deeply and looked down at his computer screen, searching for something helpful to say. Am I going to die? I said. A blank face. Bastard. He had no fucking idea. Well, there are many good treatments these days. There's every reason to have hope. There were a pair of young twins diagnosed in the town last year who are doing very well now. I can't say much more as it's not my field, but we've been in touch with the haematology unit over at the Royal Shrewsbury Hospital. They've prepared a room and they'd like you in today. What, right now? Yes, they said it's critical that they start treatment and run further tests as soon as possible. Go home and get a bag together, some clothes and whatever else you need, and then make your way there. They will be expecting you. I'm sorry to have to be the one to break this news to you, he said. He seemed genuinely apologetic now, yet clearly uncomfortable to be sharing his office with this tsunami of raw emotion. I felt something inside me clunking onwards, like the wheel of a giant metal cog turning. Okay, well, let's get on with it then. Somehow, we made it out of that suffocating panelled room and back outside to our little red car. A gaggle of spotty school kids shuffled past on their way home, shirts hanging out, laughing and joking. They have no idea of what just happened, I thought. They have no idea how precious their life is. We all take the gift of our aliveness for granted. Mum drove numbly up through town, navigating Friday's post-work traffic up to the family home. Shattered and dazed, our entrance burst a bubble of tea-time energy, composed of my three younger siblings, the kitchen radio pumping out Radio 4's 6 o'clock news, and Dad in the centre at the counter, a tea towel slung across his shoulder, poised with his knife chopping up vegetables for dinner. He took one look at our faces, dropped the knife, and ran towards the door.
"He's got leukemia,"
Mum blurted out, sobbing. We folded into his arms in tears while my brother and sisters came to sit awkwardly around the kitchen table, unsure of how to react. I hugged them fiercely in turn until they too began to well up with tears. As softly as she could through her evident pain, Mum tried to explain what the doctor had said. It was deadly serious. Her son, their brother, was very, very ill. I felt like she was talking about someone else, someone who wasn't sat right next to her holding her hand. But this was happening to me. I felt sick at the thought of what was going on inside my body. My bone marrow had gone rogue and turned against me, pumping out traitorous white blood cells and sending them off to cause havoc. We sat together as dark clouds of uncertainty and loss loomed heavily above us. Everything was happening so fast and none of us knew anything about it, other than the fact that my life depended on being admitted into the hospital that evening. Dad went to the shops and bought me back a bag of snacks, usually tightly controlled in our house. Now it was different. Suddenly I could have whatever I wanted. I went upstairs and limply began to pack a bag with some essentials. After throwing a few pairs of pants and favoured t-shirts into a pile, I slumped down to the floor with my back to the white radiator in the corner of the room. A fierce heat emanated from its core and I could feel its ridges begin to sear themselves into my skin through my shirt. I accepted the pain, willing it to make me feel something other than this. The telephone that lived in our hallway was grey and old. Time-squashed particles of dust had morphed together to become faintly inlaid in the cracks around its base. I picked it up and walked back to my room, cradling it with care, hoping it could support me as I made the call. I swallowed hard, my throat growing dry. Felt my leg muscles contracting. It had been a matter of hours and I didn't feel ready to even talk about it, let alone think about what it could mean or where it might take me. Nothing felt real, as if I'd slipped into a vivid and ludicrous nightmare with no way of waking myself up. I sat on the edge of my bed in my box-like bedroom and stared at the cheap plastic handset. That phone call remains the most heart-wrenching one I've ever had to make. The phone felt wrong to be lying in my hands. I just wanted to hold her body tightly, to hear her tell me everything would be all right. Eventually, through several deep and quivering breaths, I dialed her number, halfway through realising I'd missed out a two. I wiped the wetness from my red and puffy eyes, redialed and held the phone close to my ear, leaning forward over the side of the bed. My eyes met the wooden floor and blinked a few times at the shrill ringing. Silence. Buzz. Silence. Buzz. Silence.
"Hello, this is Simon Claude," a voice said curtly.
"Is Tasha there, please? It's Jodie," I managed to mumble.
"Oh, right, hello. Yes, she is. I'll just go and get her."
There was a rattle as the phone was dropped, followed by a series of muffled bangs.
"Tasha, telephone for you. It's Jodie. Tasha, did you hear me?"
"Yes, Dad, I'm fucking coming. Chill out."
I braced myself. "Hey, you." "Hi, Tash. How are you?"
"I'm good, Jode. What's up? You sound down."
"Well, that's because I am a bit down," I choked.
"Old Jodie, what is it? Tell me."
"Where are you?"
"In the kitchen. Why?"
"I think you should go up to your room. I'd like to talk to you there."
"Okay, give me a second."
I listened in as she crossed the warm kitchen floor and pictured her jogging up the thickly carpeted stairs, pushing back her bedroom door plastered with photos, and eventually landing with a flop on the soft blue double bed.
"I'm here, all ears. What's going on?"
"Well, you know my blood test today?"
"Yeah. Was it all okay? Was it glandular fever like they thought?"
"Well, no, it wasn't okay, Tash. It wasn't okay at all." Now the tears came. The bastards have a mean sense of timing. Tasha was quiet. She knew something bad was coming. This stopped her from speaking and gave me the space to compose myself. They found that my white blood cell count was really high, like off the charts. I've been diagnosed with leukemia. I trailed off into muffled sobs as more tears tracked down my face. That set her off and she started to cry down the phone into my better ear. There we were, tucked away in our bedroom several miles apart, both in floods of tears. Life had shattered. I felt a part of myself float up and out of my body to watch the scene unfold. Leukemia? What? Like cancer? Oh, fuck, Jode. What does that mean? She asked. Her voice quivered slightly as my heart thumped. I'm not going to fucking die, Tash. I surprised myself with the ferocity of my statement. A silence emerged. I don't know what to say. I'm so sorry, Jodie. You're going to be okay though, right? She questioned. Her words were coming quicker. She sounded panicked. I don't know, Tasha. I just don't know. I've got to go into Shrewsbury Hospital tonight. We're leaving in a few minutes. The doctor said they want to start treatment as soon as they can. They say because I'm young, I have a good chance, I explained. Did I really believe any of that? This can't be happening. It's not fair. It's not fucking fair. I know, Jode, I know. But you'll get through this. We'll get through this. I wish I could be there right now with you. We exchanged bruised farewell sentiments, devoid of their usual spark. I promised her I'd find out a number she could call for updates, and she promised to come and see me the next day. I asked her not to tell anyone we knew. It was too soon for explanations. What an ugly duty, to shatter our bright new love and infuse it with the scent of imminent. I hung up the phone, blurry-eyed and broken. I just wanted to climb into bed and wrap myself up in the duvet until it all went away. A mixture of rage and fear brewed up inside me. I could almost sense the arrival of the vultures, watching the scene, riding high on the thermals. I wondered how long I had left in this world. At 17, this is not the kind of question you expect to have to ask yourself. Nothing can prepare you. Nothing can be taught. You can only take it as it hits you, feel the fullness of the blow, allow yourself to spin and fall, and then, somehow, summon the will to get back up again. I had to gather a bag together. How do you pack for the indefinite? All I could do was focus on what was right in front of me. My battered holdall, a week's worth of underpants, a few clothes, and a toothbrush. Outside my window, the day had desaturated to monochrome and lifeless tones of grey as the sun bid us good night. Dad came upstairs and gently knocked on my bedroom door. Come on, Jode, he said softly. We better get going. And that's it for this episode of the Lumieres podcast. I intend to be back with you in the not too distant future with some fascinating interviews and conversations. In the meantime, Chimera is out now, online, in paperback and ebook. The audiobook is scheduled to be finished and out in the spring. So I do hope you enjoyed that very special preview. If you want to find out more, you can go to my website, which is jodiewhite.co.uk/the-book. Thank you for your time today. As always, the intro and outro music is provided by Six Organs of Admittance, aka Ben Chasney. If you like his music, and there is a lot to like about it, you can go to sixorgans.com, which is his personal website, and you can find out more about Ben's music. Thank you once again for listening. Stay safe out there. And go well.
We found our way. The light.